Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Scott Rutherford. Thank you, Scott. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, thank you, Emma. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming to this Orthopaedic Club webinar. Today we're going to talk about fractures in skeletally immature animals. We'll go through some of the principles and the challenges that these cases present, but we're going to do it by following a number of cases. So one of the problems in fractures in skeletally immature animals is that they can be difficult to diagnose, and it can lead to quite serious sort of consequences. So the cases here, the case that we have on the left, we have a CT scan of a Labrador's leg, and at the bottom you can see is quite significant varus deformity over here. Okay. And then the case on the right, we have a border collie that had a femoral physeal fracture that was missed. So both these cases ended up with significant lameness as a result of misdiagnosis of or mistreatment of a fracture. And the problem with these dogs and cats are that because of their significant growth potential, problems are amplified. It's not just malunions or delayed unions we see. We see consequences, and the consequences can be in the entire limb, from the proximal to distal extent. So about half of the long bone fractures that we see in dogs occur in animals that are less than a year old. Okay. And about a quarter to a third of long bone fractures are physeal. And as I said to you before, it can sometimes be difficult to diagnose these. You have to have a high index of suspicion. Many fractures will be missed with the resulting consequences. So I always think if a young animal comes in with an acute severe lameness, that dog or cat should be better by the next day. Okay, if it's bashed its toe, got a bruise, something like that. These dogs can be very lame, but they will rapidly improve. If you have suspicion of fracture on the first clinical exam, or indeed that animal is still very severely lame in 24 hours despite the analgesia you've given it, then you should be thinking, could there be a fracture that isn't that obvious? All right. And in that way, you'll radiograph these dogs or cats more frequently and pick up the fractures. Having said that, it does take a little bit sometimes to interpret the radiograph, so that can also be difficult, but they can always be sent off for help from specialists, etc. As I said to you, the consequence of a misdiagnosis or delayed treatment can be quite significant, and this leads to unhappy clients. So as I say, if you have a high index of suspicion, you will miss less of these fractures. Now, what makes fractures in these young patients different? Okay, there's both pros and cons to the age. Now, some of the benefits of age is that you have a rapid healing potential. I mean, often these fractures will be completely healed in 2 to 4 weeks. Okay, so it's very, very rapid. And they generally healed by abundant callus, as is seen in this radiograph here. We've got significant amounts of callus down here in the sort of distal mid tibia. And they have a very active and rapid remodeling. Okay. So although, as you can see here, the tibia looks misshapen because of the very rapid bone turnover remodeling, This will reshape to the loads expected by the tibia. Now, what that means, because you have rapid healing, you get abundant callus, and you get this very rapid remodeling. If we are going to attempt to surgically fix these, prompt reduction and fixation is necessary. So these are benefits, but they also can cause problems. And the longer you leave a fracture in an immature animal, the harder it is to reduce and reconstruct. The very good news is that non-union of these dogs is, I mean, is almost unheard of. It's not impossible, but very, very rare. The challenges that come about with these fractures, though, are that we generally have poor bone stock. So the bone is very, very soft in these patients. The younger the patient is, the softer the bone. And the cortices can be very thin. And that's especially true in the femur. And physeal fractures, by their very nature, are very close to the joint. So as you can see here, we have a fracture across the distal radial physis. That means we've got very little bone stock distally to get implants in. Okay. And obviously, because these animals are growing, we have the potential for growth retardation or deformity, as we said. Now that can happen whether you treat these successfully or adequately or not. We're going to look at diaphyseal fractures and physeal fractures separately. So we'll talk about diaphyseal fractures first. And we really think about splitting these into two age categories. Okay, if it's less than 5 months old, certainly less than 4 months old, we will treat those differently than patients that are over 5 months of age. Now, obviously, there is some leeway depending on the breed. Okay, if it's one of the giant dogs, then potentially we'd look at, you know, treating them at 6 months old differently. But as a broad guideline, 5 months is a good age to split them. And if they're over 5 months old, we'll treat those almost as an adult. All right. We expect the bone is of better quality. The growth potential is less than it was previously. So although there are some things we have to do differently, we're going towards treating those as an adult. And the big one here is that if we have an open growing physis, we don't want to bridge that with an implant or lock it if that can be avoided, okay? Because that will not allow the physis to grow on that side. And if it's still growing on the other side, that will lead to a growth deformity. So in our young patients, especially under 5 months old, the diaphysis is extremely elastic and resilient to fracture. Okay, and what that actually means is it withstands greater deformation before it fractures. Basically, it will bend more, okay, or twist more before you have an ultimate fracture. And because of the elasticity and resilience of it, we see a lot of incomplete fractures, the so-called green stick fractures, where they don't go all the way through all the cortices. Okay, we can see that in this radiograph over here, all right, that we have this little fracture coming across, and it would appear that the cortices are intact at least part of the way. The periosteum is also loosely attached. It's very thick, okay? So what that means is the periosteum strips away from the bone very easily. It's very vascular, the periosteum, so you get lots of bleeding, which leads to a large hematoma, and then you get rapid callus formation. Because the periosteum is thick and it's stripped away easily, it often is left intact, and that acts like a sleeve around the bone that restrains and stabilizes the bone itself. So the periosteum gives an intrinsic stability to a lot of these fractures, hence why you see the minimally displaced or non-displaced displaced fractures. There's multiple different ways of treating these diaphyseal fractures. Broadly, we can split that into strict rest, so non-surgical management, external coaptation, external skeletal fixation, the use of an intramedullary pin or a bone plate, and we'll talk about those separately. We'll start with external coaptations. So this could take the form of a cast or a splint or a Robert Jones dressing. And generally what happens is you'll apply traction to the limb, try to have a closed reduction of the fracture, get joint alignment correct, limb length correct, and then apply your external coaptation, whatever form that would take. And this is reported. However, it requires extremely diligent management. These dogs are growing, and they're growing quite rapidly. So the bandage or cast, splint, whatever it is, needs frequent changing, and probably at least weekly, if not more. All right. And you need frequent radiographic follow-up, because what you want to do is you want to remove the bandage as soon as you possibly can, as soon as you have evidence of some radiographic union. Now, one of the major problems with external coaptation is the huge complication rate. External coaptation has a high complication rate in adults, and there's studies that look at that, about 60% of cases, and it's even higher in my experience in small animals, in young animals. There's a very long list of complications that can happen. The first one is deformity. So we'll often see a valgal or torsional deformity, and that's because the bandage, the cast, the splint cannot counteract all of the forces acting on that fracture. And often you will see that the casts and bandages are bad at resisting torsion, so the joint above and below the fracture can twist within the dressing. Okay, it might not be to a huge degree, but sometimes a few degrees of deformity is all it takes to have consequences on the joints in close proximity. Valgal deformities will happen. Obviously, this is where the distal limb is bent outwards, if you like. That will happen because, again, unless it's a cast, it's not, these dressings are not good at resisting bending forces, and even casts aren't perfect. So you'll often get deformities, malunions of the fracture, despite your best efforts. The next set of complications is fracture disease, and these can be devastating. So we have joint laxity, okay, where the ligaments in a joint that have been bandaged and immobilized become lax. So there is instability within that joint. You can get periarticular fibrosis. Joints are designed to move. That is their purpose. And if they're not moving, the joint health suffers, and they will thicken, and you will get a decreased range of motion. That happens in adults, but it's amplified in the immature patient. So joints can become thickened and fibrosed. Again, just the same with the cartilage within the joint. Cartilage is meant to be loaded. It's designed for that. And if it's not happening, then the cartilage can degenerate. You can get a decrease in the collagen, the quality of the collagen, and also the matrix within the cartilage itself, which can have long-term effects on the joint. Disuse osteopenia is possible in these patients. So bone can literally die in front of your eyes. Again, it is a tissue. It's meant to be loaded. And if the animal cannot use the leg because of the bandage, then the bone weakens over time, okay? And less bone is laid down, more bone is taken away, and that can be disastrous as well. The bone can literally disappear, and you can cause other iatrogenic fractures, or the patient might not even recover. Muscular contracture is another problem, and we'll talk about that a bit more in a slide that's just coming. In the pelvic limb, if the leg isn't used properly, then the hip joint doesn't develop as it should do because its normal load forces aren't traversing the hip. So you can actually end up with coxa valga, which is where you have an increased femoral neck angle, and you can get an increased angle of antiversion in the femoral neck, and both of these lead to sort of iatrogenic hip dysplasia, and then all the consequences of that. When we talk about joint laxity, the carpus is the normal one, the one that's most commonly affected. And if you bandage or cast, especially large breed dogs, you'll end up with a degree of carpal hyperextension. So the carpus is dropped, if you like, to the ground. Now, this is the least problematic of the complications. It's normally reversible when you take the bandage or cast off and get the dog exercising again. The worst thing you can do is splint these. We need the dog to use the leg again, and the laxity improves and disappears. Quadriceps contracture is a devastating complication following femur fractures. And we will see this in specifically dogs, larger dogs normally, that have had a femoral fracture that's been misdiagnosed or mistreated. And what happens is the quadriceps is tied down to the fracture callus, and that happens over a period of time. That causes pain. The dog doesn't use the leg as it should do. So over time, the muscle contracts. We'll also get stifle fibrosis. So what happens is the stifle is held in hyperextension, as you can see in this case here. Okay, and then down with the shepherd at the bottom here. So these dogs have a marked lameness and an inability to flex the stifle that's really, really painful. And if you have a case that's going this way, if we can recognise it earlier, then we can reverse it to a degree with aggressive physiotherapy. But if it becomes very contracted, then it has a poor prognosis. We've attempted to release quadriceps and use skeletal fixators to help with stifle flexion. But the overall the prognosis is poor. And as I say, if you have a distal femoral fracture that's adequately managed, then this will be a very, very rare complication, thankfully. So strict rest, what do we mean by strict rest? Generally that's a cage, okay? Now, if you have an incomplete, minimally displaced fracture, as we saw in the earlier radiograph and again here, so we have this fracture, it would appear to be incomplete. We also have an intact fibula. Okay, so there's some inherent instability to this fracture. The periosteum has probably intact and will be acting as the restraining sleeve. Okay, I basically would never place external coaptation on this. I will just put this animal into a cage and strictly rest it. And I'll re-radiograph it really quite quickly, probably in 7 to 10 days. Just to make sure that nothing else has happened, that we don't have displacement of the fracture or fracture of the fibula. When you're happy a week down the line that everything seems to be intact, you'll start to encourage limb use, take the dog for frequent short walks with a gradual increase in exercise, and hopefully that will minimise your fracture disease complications, so the cartilage degeneration, your joint fibrosis, things like quadriceps contracture, other muscle contractures. And this is my treatment of choice for young patients, especially they're up to 3 months old, even up to 4 months old. Okay. Now, the difference comes if you have displacement. Okay. If you have displacement, then you don't have some intrinsic stability of the fracture. It's moving around. So they generally need to have some stabilization performed. Okay. But if you have an incomplete, certainly, or a minimally displaced fracture, then strict rest is a good way to go. And as I say, certainly, I would never put a bandage on any of these. If you look at external skeletal fixation, that can be quite useful in our young patients. Now, I'm not a particular fan of external skeletal fixation. I try not to use it. External fixators compared to bone plates have a higher complication rate in adult animals. They are not as stiff and as robust a repair, and they're generally not particularly well liked by owners. They don't like metalwork sticking out. They don't like the fact that you'll get some pin track discharges, etc. But in our young patient, they can be very useful because they're not going to be on in place for a particularly long period. Low stiffness fixators are beneficial in dogs and cats. The fracture could have some intrinsic stability because of the periosteal sleeve, and because we've got rapid healing, a little bit of micro motion at the fracture can actually be beneficial for callus, to promote callus formation. So the fact that they are less stiff than plates can be useful, and we can alter the stiffness of the fixator as well. So in these very young patients, what we'll generally do is use two and two pins. So two pins above the fracture and two pins below the fracture. What we mustn't do with this is traverse a fracture. So traverse the physis. So bridge the physis. That's not good news because we will retard growth on that side that we have locked with the fixator. We don't want to penetrate paired bones. We certainly don't want to go all the way through the radius into the ulna, for example, because that will link those bones together. You could get a synostosis where you get bony union in between the two, which can be painful, or we could cause other growth deformities that way. And we want to make sure that we don't insert the pins into fissures in the bone. One of the problems with external skeletal fixator is that, as we said earlier, the cortices of immature animals' bone is very thin, so you have a poor bone implant interface. Okay, so loosening of the pins are common. Now, it's a race between the pins loosening and the bone healing. Okay, and as long as we haven't damaged the fracture site too much, and we adequately place the fixator, generally healing wins the race. So it will be healed adequately before the implants are too loose and you get construct failure. So in this case, this is a 3 month old labradoodle that had a radius and ulna fracture, as can be seen here. There's some displacement. There was instability palpable. And because both bones are fractured, the radius and the ulna, it was decided that this needed a form of stabilisation. Our options are plating or using the fixator. And this particular fracture lends itself quite nicely to a fixator because we have plenty of bone above and below. We should get rapid healing and we can take the fixator off and leave no bone metalwork in the body. What we've done with the lines here is calibrated the radiograph and then made some measurements from anatomical landmarks so we know exactly where the fracture line is and where the joints are, where the physes are, so that we can then place our pins, missing the fracture, missing fissures, missing the physes and the joints. We'll talk about this case, a three-month-old labradoodle that had a complete fracture of the radius and ulna, as can be seen here. Now this was a unstable fracture, so the decision was made that we needed some form of stabilisation, and this fracture lends itself to external fixation because we have significant amount of bone above and below the fracture. So the frame was put on with the two pins above and below, and then we can see the fracture 4 weeks later. Okay, and we've got complete healing of the fracture with abundant callus, as we described. Now, the two distal pins appear as if they're going into the ulna. They're not. They're just sort of skiffing off it, if you like, which isn't perfect, but you can see that from here, from the physis to the distal pin here, we've got significant growth, and you can see the same proximally. Okay, so the bones, the ulna and the radius have continued to grow successfully, and the fracture's healed. In the next slide, we have a 12-week-old Shih Tzu. And here we have a long oblique fracture of the proximal tibial diaphysis and into the metaphysis. And the fibula is actually gone in this as well. Okay, so this is an unstable again. So again, the decision was that it needed to be stabilized. And again, that's been achieved with an external fixator with two pins above and two pins below the fracture, as can be seen here. 3 weeks post-op, we've taken the connecting bar off and re-radiographed, and you can see a complete healing of the fracture, okay, with quite an abundant callus, although that's already remodeling. Okay, we've got callus here. Again, we can see on this that there is an increased distance between the distal pin in the physis and the proximal pin in the physis. So again, the tibia has continued to heal and grow in length. Again, successful. So the frame's taken off at that point. We can also use intramedullary pins. These would tend to have a relatively small diameter compared to what you would think of using in an adult, so less than the sort of 50-60% of the medullary cavity. That's because there's a high percentage of cancellous bone in the medullary cavity, so that has better stability of the intramedullary pin. These pins don't tend to interfere with growth. They're smooth pins that go perpendicular to the growth plate. So the physis can continue to grow around them and the pin can just grow and be pulled out. You can plan to remove these if you want, but they can also be incorporated. You can see that in this radiograph here that we've got this pin relatively long going all the way down into the distal femur. And then number of weeks post-operatively, okay, the femur has grown and the pin's actually now incorporated within the medullary cavity, so you couldn't remove that. Now, it's often good to think about using these with an external fixator or a plate, Okay. Intramedullary pins are not very good at counteracting resisting torsion. So often fractures will fail, but they can be used alone in the immature patient. Bone plates are useful. There's always sort of talked about not using bone plates in young animals, which is not the case. We'll often use bone plates to stabilize fractures. We've got different techniques with the sort of conventional plating techniques. You can do it very similar to as we would in an adult animal. Plates have many advantages, especially in more unstable fractures, okay, because we will get better stability constructs than with an external fixator. And as I pointed out earlier, there's a higher complication rate with external fixators as opposed to bone plate fixation. And there's some owner dissatisfaction with skeletal fixators, they're not particularly well liked. However, there are problems with bone plates. The thin cortex, especially in the femur, means that screw loosening is possible. Although to some degree, the risk of that is reduced with the newer locking plate fixation. With bone plates, you must remember not to bridge the physis. Okay, the idea is that if we're using a bone plate, that it's proximal or distal to the physis, and that we don't lock that physis in one side, which could cause abnormal growth. Although sometimes that's not the case and is inevitable, things like humeral condylar fractures, we can't often stabilize the more complex ones without bridging the physis, but it is a consideration, and you would never start out with the aim to bridge the physis if you could avoid it. Bone plates, it was always talked that they had to be removed after about 3 to 5 weeks, and that would prevent entrapment of the plate by the bone growing over it, if you like. However, I don't take bone plates out, never have, unless they cause a problem. With the oops, the wrong way, excuse me. Another form of using plates would be elastic osteosynthesis. And that's where we use a relatively small plate. Okay, for example, we'd use a 2.7 millimeter plate for a medium or large breed dog. And the plate spans the length of the bone. Okay. So all the way from the proximal extent to the distal. You make no attempt to reduce the fracture, and you use a small number of screws at either end. So two or three screws at either end of the plate. Okay. These screws are placed in the metaphyseal region. That's where there's a lot of trabecular bone. So the screws are more stable, and they're not having to deal with the very thin cortices that you'd see in the mid diaphysis. Okay, this is a specialist type of fracture fixation, and one of the problems with this, if you're not careful, would be obviously implant failure. This is really pushing the envelope, and you have to be careful. And if you do this, you will have failures. So this isn't something that's recommended unless you really know what you're doing. If we take this case of an 8-week-old Pomeranian, suffered a distal diaphyseal fracture, and so the challenges with this are it's a femoral fracture, so the cortices are very thin. It's very distal. So we don't have much bone stock here before the physis to get implants in. It's a very young dog, so it has, even though it's a small Pomeranian, it's got a large growth potential. So what I've done in this case is use an intramedullary pin, okay, that comes down, spans over the fracture, and then we've used a very small plate, okay, and all we've managed to get is one screw below the fracture and this sort of two screws above, one of which is monocortical. And the idea of the plate here is just to resist a little bit of the rotation at the intramedullary pin. And we just had a question come in asking, would you use an IM pin alone or alongside? Now, I generally would almost never use an IM pin or on its own. I generally use it alongside something else. So like a plate rod construct as we have here, or a pin and an external fixator. You will get away with using an IM pin, but often, as I say, they are not good at resisting rotation torsion. So you could get failures or non-unions, malunions even. So this case again, we have the 6-month-old border collie, so we can treat that a little bit more like an adult. The challenges with this fracture are the distance between the fracture line and the distal physis. We don't have a huge amount of bone stock there, and being the femur, it does have thinner cortices. So what we've done here is applied a lateral bone plate alone, and we have three screws above and three screws below. But you can see that the physis, we haven't traversed the physis. When we come to 6 weeks post-operatively, we have a complete fracture union. Right. And again, you can see the physis has moved away from the bone. So although there's not a huge growth potential left, there has been some, and the bone has continued to grow. In this case, we have a horrendous fracture on a 5-month-old border collie, comminuted mid-diaphyseal fracture. This case illustrates another method of fixation that we have. We've done this through minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis. So because the fracture is so comminuted, there's no way of reconstructing it. So what we've done is we've used an intramedullary pin to achieve limb length, and then with plates we've put a medial plate on traversing the entire length of the bone, and a cranial plate on to hold that all in position. 5 weeks down the line from that horrible fracture, you can see abundant callus formation here, okay? And we have clinical union of the fracture already, despite the fact it's been a horrible fracture. So with physeal fractures, we have to think of these for what they are. The physis is where the longitudinal growth of bone occurs through endochondral ossification. There's a little graphic here to remind everybody what the physis is composed of. We have a reserve zone of cells, so this is closest to the physis. Then we have a proliferative zone where the cells proliferate, and then they go through maturation, degeneration, and then the calcification into bone. So that's how the bones grow in length. And this is important for us to think of physeal injuries. So the physis is actually weaker than the surrounding bone, joint capsule, and ligaments. Right. And that's why in these young patients we see physeal fractures most commonly, rather than metaphyseal fractures, even diaphyseal fractures, or joint luxations. When we look at the classification of these, there is a standard classification system, the Salter-Harris classification, that everybody is aware of. And here we have type 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Type 1 is a fracture just straight through the physis. Type 2 is a fracture that goes across the physis and then up as a metaphyseal segment. A type 3, the fracture goes through the physis but down the epiphysis towards the joint. A type 4 goes from the joint through the epiphysis and up through the metaphysis. And a type 5 is a compressive fracture. So you don't necessarily see any signs of an injury there. Now, this classification system was originally designed to prognosticate on the healing of these fractures, but it doesn't do that at all. So it's just a classification of the type of fracture seen. The consequences of physeal injury can be quite significant. If the growth is disrupted and you don't get growth, you can get limb shortening. If you get disparate growth between different parts of the physis or different bones and paired bone systems, you can get angular deformities. If you get, as again, disparate growth, you can get joint incongruence, okay, because areas of the line, that the joints don't line up as they should do. And you can also get osteoarthritis, because some of these physeal injuries, fractures, are actually articular in origin. And so you've damaged the joint, you've damaged the cartilage, that will always lead to osteoarthritis. And again, as we said, to avoid some of these consequences, we want prompt diagnosis and prompt treatment. Okay. However, it's important to remember that complications can happen regardless of what you do. Okay. So if we adequately treat these physeal fractures, about 10% will have growth deformities. So the principles of treating the physeal fractures, again, prompt treatment, ideally within 3 days. We'll do it up to 5 days, that's absolutely fine. When we get past 5 days, we're concerned. And it depends on the nature of the fracture, whether we make any attempt to do that or not. For example, a capital physeal fracture after 5 days, it's not worth your while even attempting it. Whereas if you have a humeral condylar fracture, we will make attempts because we don't have any other good option. So we will try and improve things. We want to try and use the least reduction, the least fixation properly. Okay, we want to damage the physis, further damage it the least we possibly can, and that includes how we reduce it, but also how we stabilise the fracture. If it was possible, we'd want to do a closed reduction. That's not often impossible. Okay, so if we go in and have to do a standard open approach, we want very gentle manipulation of the physis. We don't want to crush the germinal cartilage any more than has already happened. As I said before, we don't want to bridge the physis with locking implants. So if we put anything across the physis, we want the physis to be able to grow around that implant. That will happen with small diameter smooth pins, but it won't if it's a threaded pin or a screw, or if we cross at too acute an angle, okay, that will actually lock the physis and not allow it to grow around that implant. And again, another principle of all fracture surgery, but especially in the small dogs, we want early limited weight bearing to minimise the effects of fracture disease. So how can we fix physeal fractures? Multiple ways. We have cross pins, intramedullary pins, dynamic K-wires or rush pins, pin and tension band wire, temporary external fixators, lag screws, and plates, although these would generally be limited to humeral condylar fractures, okay, because we are needing accurate anatomical reconstruction and we don't have many other options other than to lag screw and plate. Now, in this case, when you're lag screwing condylar fractures, you're not lag screwing across the physis, you're lag screwing parallel to it and therefore have minimum effect. Same with the plates. It depends where we put the plates in the age of the dog, whether we would be able to do that or not. But we have to be cognizant with plates that really we don't want to bridge across the physis and affect the growth. So here we have a 5-month-old German Shepherd dog. This is a CT scan, but the CT was taken because it had multiple other injuries, but we can see we have a capital physeal fracture, okay, here. So there's the capital physis and then the femoral neck. It's displaced quite a way. These are challenging fractures to fix. They require prompt diagnosis and they're easily missed. I see a number of these that have been missed, okay. Here, what we've done is we've placed 3 divergent K wires that all just penetrate into the physis, the epiphysis, and don't cross out of the cartilage or across the joint. In this case, 6 weeks down the line, we had complete healing of the fracture. One of the problems that can happen with this is because the blood supply to the femoral neck is not particularly robust and easily damaged, you can get apple coring, and where the you get lysis and loss of the femoral neck, so that can happen even after adequate surgery. So these are complex fractures to manage, and can result in significant complications. Here we have a distal femoral physeal fracture here in a 7-month-old domestic short hair. And what we've done here is dynamic K wiring. Okay, so this is slightly different to rush pins, because rush pins are a particular type of pin that already have a sort of bent over section distally. But we just used K wires to have a dynamic effect. So in effect, what happens is a hole is drilled distally and the K wire is slightly bent before you put it in, with the tip cut at an angle, so that as you place the K wire in, it hits the cortex and comes up. Okay, so it doesn't penetrate. And these lock in position, and they give very good stability of the distal femoral physis. You can cross pin a distal the femur, but where you start from, often it's difficult to exit the pins in the correct position. Okay, as we'll come to see later, when you use cross pins, you don't want the pins to cross at the physis, because that doesn't give much stability, okay? And that can happen in the distal femur. So cross pinning can be done in the distal femur, but rush pinning is a sort of more elegant way of achieving a better result. In this case, we have a 5-month-old Staffordshire Bull Terrier, and we have a fracture both of the tibial tuberosity apophysis as well as the proximal tibial physis here. Okay, now what happens here is the tuberosity and the epiphysis, or the tibial epiphysis, are still connected. They haven't displaced. Okay, so what we'll do to use that is try reduce the fracture to a degree, place a K wire across as the pin, and then a tension band, because this is in effect a an avulsion fracture. The quadriceps through the patellar ligament is pulling on the tibial tuberosity and pulling this up. Okay, so by stabilizing the tibial tuberosity, we've indirectly stabilized the proximal tibial physis, and haven't needed to manipulate that anymore or put any further implants that could affect the growth. With these fractures, the consideration that we always have is a retardation of the growth of the proximal physis. Therefore, could we end up with a pathologically steep tibial plateau angle. So that's one of the considerations here, because then we would expect that that would put increased stress on the cranial cruciate ligament, which is already a very common cause of lameness. So one of the considerations we have here is what happens to the tibial plateau, and will that predispose to cranial cruciate ligament disease later in life. Postoperatively, we have healing of the fracture 4 weeks down the line. Okay, complete healing. Again, I leave these implants in. No need to take them out unless they cause any problems. The next case, we have a 10-month-old domestic short hair. We have a distal tibial physeal fracture with significant displacement. What we've done here is cross pin. Okay, so we have pins coming from the lateral malleolus, the distal fibula, and the medial malleolus, and crossing over and exiting the tibia on the opposite cortex. What we can see here is these pins cross above, proximal to the physis, so that's very important. Okay, the crossing should not happen at the physis itself, and this will allow growth if it was to happen. Here we have a 10-month-old Bengal, and this is a CT reconstruction. But what we actually have is this is the epiphysis of the tibia, so it's displaced. Okay, then displaced medially, and then we have the rest of the tibia over here. So what we've done in this case, okay, is put in some pins across from the medial malleolus, across the physis, and through the lateral cortex of the tibia. But because that's not a very robust repair, okay, and there was significant displacement of the epiphysis, we've placed a temporary transarticular skeletal fixator. Okay, where we've got three pins above and we've got these four pins below, because these end up being smaller diameter pins distally in the metatarsals. And this frame is left on for 3 or 4 weeks, okay, just until we have enough healing that we're happy to take that off. And again, there are downsides with this frame, because it will inhibit growth potentially. Although at 10 months, that's not really of concern, but it also stops the hock moving. So you can get joint fibrosis, cartilage degeneration. So whenever we use a temporary frame, especially in a young animal, we want to use it for the least time possible. This case, we've got 6 weeks down the line, the frame was removed. Okay, we look at the images close up. This was immediately post-op, and you can still see the physis. It's fairly obvious, so open, whereas here, 6 weeks down the line, it's less obvious. We have a complete fracture healing. The frame was taken off, and 6 weeks is quite a late to take that frame off. Ideally, you'd want to do it before that. But because of owner factors, that didn't happen in this case. And the cat did have reduced hock flexion, but that improved with time. Here we have a 5-month-old Chihuahua that came in with a distal radial physeal fracture. And you can see here it's a Salter Harris type 2, because you have this little metaphyseal segment here. Okay. This dog is tiny. This dog is 1.1 kilograms. So we have limited options. What we've done is placed cross pins again. So we're coming from medial and lateral through the the distal radial epiphysis. And again, you can see that the pins cross above the physis. Okay. This pin is overlong, but that was actually removed post-op. You can tell how big these are 1.1 millimeter pins, and they look huge in this dog. 4 weeks post-operatively, when we look at this, the fracture's completely healed. Okay, and at that point, this pin was removed. Okay. Now that goes through some of the common ways of treating the physeal injuries. So you should be happier at dealing with diaphyseal fractures and physeal fractures. But it's one of the things is, as we said at the start, is what is the consequence of misdiagnosis? And that can be quite significant. This is the case of the dog with the capital physeal fracture that had been missed. So this dog went acutely lame and it recovered quite quickly. So he's non-weight bearing. Within days, he was using the leg, but with a sort of mild to moderate lameness. But because the dog had improved so much, no further investigation was done. It was assumed this dog had got better. And what happens is that lameness progressed over a period of time because he had a malunion of the femoral capital physeal fracture. There's nothing you can do about this now. It's too down the line. It's going to get a lot of joint degeneration, secondary osteoarthritis. So our only option is salvage surgery. So this dog moved and had a total hip replacement. So this dog was seven or 8 months old and required a total hip replacement because there wasn't the high index of suspicion needed to diagnose that. I've done multiple hip replacements on cases like this where it's been missed. Okay. And it's because the dogs significantly improve quite quickly. Although that doesn't, they don't improve to normal. Okay. This is the other case that showed earlier where this dog sustained a tibial, diaphyseal, and physeal fracture. And so on this side, you can see the CT, the leg comes down, we've got significant varus deformity where the foot is pointing in the way. This dog also had a significant torsional deformity, and we compare that to its contralateral limb, nice and straight. So this dog was extremely lame and progressively so. Again, what had happened in this case is that the dog had had trauma, gone acutely lame. Nothing was found because it was a relatively stable fracture on examination, and the dog rapidly improved. However, there was always a lameness left, a residual lameness, and that just progressively got worse. So there hadn't been the high index of suspicion for a fracture. So the fracture was missed. It could have been treated, but we unfortunately got left with this growth deformity. Talk a little bit more about growth deformities in the webinar in February, but what we've done in this case is we've used specially 3D printed guides to help us guide the where the osteotomy is and the reduction. So we have the guide in place with K wires. Then we've made our cut and we use these K wires and a different guide to line everything up to realign the leg. And this is what it looked like afterwards. You can see now we have a straight limb on radiograph. This is another common case of where we have a limb deformity because of a misdiagnosis or missed fracture. This is a young Springer Spaniel that, when it was 3 months old, went acutely lame, and within a couple of days had improved significantly. Nothing was thought about it again until the dog started to grow a bit more, and between 4 or 5 months old, started to have a deformity in the antebrachium, carpal valgus, and torsion. So here we have the normal limb, and here we have the affected limb, and you can see that there is starting to be a curve, a bowing of the radius. It's called radial procurvatum, and the ulna is bowing as well, and the growth plate is further up than you would expect. If we look at the CC views, it appears the foot's twisted. You can't see as much of the carpus, so the foot is twisted in position because of a distal ulnar physeal injury. So this dog, when it was 3 months old, had a grade 5 a type 5 Salter Harris distal ulnar physeal fracture, and because the radius and the ulna are paired bones with a strong interosseous ligament between them, the retardation of growth of the ulna has affected the growth of the radius, and the ulna effectively acts like a bowstring. What we did in this case is try to manipulate the growth. We did an incomplete ostectomy of the distal ulna at the physis, and then I deliberately bridged the physis, what I told you never to do. We deliberately bridged that with screws and a wire to try and stop the growth, okay, on the medial aspect, so that the lateral aspect would grow round, and then push the foot back medially, so you didn't have the valgus deformity. And that actually worked. So as I say, it is very important with fractures in skeletally immature animals to have a high index of suspicion to try and avoid some of the consequences of missed fractures or poor treatment. But even if you do that, it won't work in every case. Just to clear up the question that came in earlier, as I say, very seldom would I use an intramedullary pin alone. I would always use it with something else. Now, you can use an intramedullary pin alone, but I always think that you're getting away with the fixation. You're kind of a little bit lucky that it's worked. So I'd never use it alone. Another question is about, you know, how often would I cage rest a very young animal for a fracture? And there's a lot of factors that come into that. But if we have an intrinsically stable fracture, so it's an incomplete fracture, or it's minimally displaced, suggesting that the periosteum is acting as a very good restraining sleeve, or it's in a paired bone, so you have a fractured tibia, but the fibula is intact, or a fractured radius and the ulna is intact, I will be inclined to just cage rest those without any surgery. But what I want to know is that it is healing and you're not getting further displacement, so I would quickly re-radiograph those, probably a week after the initial radiographs. See, I almost never put anything in a cast. Another factor involved in that decision making is owners. You know, an owner's financial position, etc. They might not be able to afford surgery. So, in cases that might benefit from surgery and the owner can't afford them, you know, you've nothing to lose by attempting cage rest, because, as I say, these animals have very good rapid healing potential. So would you, in a bilateral femur fracture, would you fix both legs at the same time? I think that's the question. So yes, again, if surgery is indicated for a fracture to stabilise it, then I will do those at the same sitting, unless there's a reason not to. Okay, so if there's a problem with the anaesthetic or something like that. You know, we're dealing with very young patients here potentially, so anaesthetic is of greater risk, temperature, all of this. You might decide to stage the fracture fixation, you know, a day or two apart, but we don't have a long window of opportunity here, okay? So generally, I would try and fix those at the same time. The other thing to say is that they're actually not tend to be that onerous a surgery. We're trying to do the minimum we can to get these to heal. So if the patient can cope with having both fractures fixed at the same time, yes, I certainly would.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Scott for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.